little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelich, and I'm here with the other host of the show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hey, Bob.
This, by the way, is a Julia and Bob show. We don't have a guest for this show, but we've got a lot to discuss, so I'm kind of anxious to get to it. But let's start, as we usually do, by telling folks how they can get in touch with us, pop up our previously archived podcast versions, and go to our Facebook page.
Yes, folks can get in touch with us by visiting our Facebook page. Thinking Clearly, it should come up. We are podcasting all of our shows. You can find it at thinkingclearly.libsyn.com. That's LIBSYN.com. Or open up your favorite podcast app and just search for podcast, search feed, put in Thinking Clearly, and you should find us right there. And Bob and I will show up in your podcast app every month.
I kind of enjoy these Julia and Bob shows without the guests because it kind of gives us a chance to curate an assortment of our thoughts relating to critical thinking and related topics. So that's what we're going to do. And the way this is going to go is in the first part of this episode, we're going to discuss some thoughts about the present state of our collective ability to describe reality accurately and agree on common values. That's something I like to call the state of epistemic health. And I'll take the lead in the first part and unpack some of what I think are important foundational ideas for Julia and I to discuss, ideas that I find helpful in understanding our present state of epistemic health. And then Julia will guide us through part two. We'll talk somewhat about what critical thinking is during this pandemic and maybe a little bit about the effects of the pandemic on that, because the pandemic has created a challenge to our ability to find common ground and work cooperatively toward common goals in some ways. And so we'll talk about that. I do want to note that we are pre-recording this episode, so there will be no listener call-ins for this edition of Thinking Clearly. I want to start with what I consider the foundation of my thinking or perspectives in terms of thinking about the issues that we talk about on this show. And that's an evolutionary perspective. My thinking about our ability to describe reality accurately and agree on common values rests really on an evolutionary perspective, meaning that all creatures have the ability to reproduce over generations, to be shaped by the environment. And that evolution by genetic variation and natural selection relies on the natural fact that if some biological change makes an individual within a species better able to survive and reproduce, then that change becomes enhanced in that species population. And it's amazing to realize that on our planet, that dance between life and the environment has been going on about 3.5 billion years. And for our species, Homo sapiens, only about 300,000 years. So we'll talk about things in terms of, when I talk about them, I'll be coming from an evolutionary perspective. What about you, Julia? Is evolutionary perspective part of your way of looking at the issues that we've been talking about?
I think it's always an important factor, but certainly isn't the end-all be-all. And our understanding of evolutionary psychology and biological evolution is evolving all the time, if you will. So I think it's an important aspect to keep in mind as far as who we are and how we function in this world.
I'm going to try to lay out some ideas for you. And I'm going to start out by just briefly talking about our evolutionary history. It took the path, our evolutionary history did, of developing basic cognitive abilities. And lucky we are, because we can sit here and use computer technology to chat about these issues and have other people listen to us far, far away. So some of those cognitive abilities are the ability to reason, to plan, to solve problems, to think abstractly, to comprehend complex ideas, to learn quickly and learn from experience. But because it gave us a competitive advantage to survive and reproduce, humans also evolved as a social and cultural species. And the more I think about these issues, the more important this whole idea of culture becomes to me. It consists of culture, does human culture, of rules, behavioral norms, methods, and accomplishments, including technologies, which some group of people in a particular region have developed for living together in that particular environment. And it's important to realize that culture has the properties of being cumulative, human culture does, reinforced by group behavior passed on from generation to generation, and that it's co-evolved with our biology. Now, this is kind of a new idea, and it's not universally accepted by everyone, but there is a movement to think about our biological evolution and our culture as co-evolving, meaning there are feedback loops from one to the other. They affect each other.
Absolutely. From my reading, it doesn't seem that controversial. Part of what you're talking about is what Potts refers to as variability selection. Rick Potts, who came up with the theory of variability selection, I think over 20 years ago, he's also the director of Human Origins Program at the Smithsonian Institute National Museum of Natural History. Rick Potts says our brains are essentially social brains. We share information, we create and pass on knowledge. That's the means by which humans are able to adjust to new situations. And it's what differentiates humans from our earlier ancestors and our earlier ancestors from primates. Mm-hmm. So I think this is a good, you know, demonstration of how evolution is not as simple as just biological evolution and mutation and adjustment. There's more to it as social creatures.
I can give you a specific example of that's used to support this idea of coevolution of biology and culture. And that example is our ability for adults to drink and digest milk. Now, all infants can do that. All human infants have lactase. They produce genetically produced lactase, which is an enzyme that breaks down that disaccharide that is made up of two sugars, galactose and glucose, to make up the disaccharide lactose. But after about age five, human beings historically were not able to. They lose the ability to make that lactase, and so milk becomes indigestible. But about 30% of the world's population have been able to, into adulthood, produce lactase and use milk as a nutrient. And that's tied, by people who believe in this idea of coevolution, that's tied to the idea that some of the populations that got into agrarian populations, that got into growing crops and herding and using animal products, including milk, began to slowly change biologically to the point of being able to digest lactose. So that's an example that's often cited, evolutionary practice of herding and using animal products actually was able to change our biology in about 30% of the world's population. But biological evolution is much slower than cultural evolution. Our species has mostly only had enough time to biologically adapt us to that original hunter-gatherer lifestyle, which was a lot simpler, smaller groups of a few dozen people living together, minimum of information that needed to be processed and decisions that needed to be made. But then we moved into agrarian societies around 12,000 years ago and established permanent settlements with reliable food supplies. Cities and civilizations grew, technology accelerated, and the global population boomed from about 5 million people 10,000 years ago to about 8 billion today. So the upshot for me is that understanding this tension between our ancestral biological adaptation to living in simpler times in small groups, as opposed to the present demands of living in a more modern, complex cultural environment, really helps me get some insight into how that affects our current state of epistemic health, where we're experiencing, and I want to see if you agree with this, but we're experiencing a lot of polarization and really a breakdown in ability to engage in cooperative behavior and solving problems that we face, including climate change and the tamping down of this pandemic. So those are my ideas. Any reactions to those?
No. Sorry.
Meaning you totally agree with them, you're in awe of them, or you think that's just part of the answer?
It's not controversial. I mean,
it's obvious then. Not everybody, I think, takes that perspective. But for me, that's kind of the starting point, is to realize that. Because, and there are some interesting things that are happening where people are trying to design social spaces, social media spaces, in smaller communities, thinking that the larger communities of Facebook worldwide and that sort of thing, and Twitter worldwide, are part of the problem. Inability to find common ground and make common arguments with each other.
I mean, I guess I have a hard time firmly, confidently saying that now is more polarized than ever, because I haven't really lived in other times, you know, and I can say that people today, it might be hard to believe, are murdering each other less. There's less violence. We're actually living in a better world than has existed in the past. And so sometimes that's why I get a little baffled by the idea that we need to regress in some way. You mentioned the example of social media would be more well adapted to smaller social circles. That might very well be true, but I don't see that as the core problem of social media. I see capitalism as the core problem of social media. And if we had social media removed from capitalism, I think that would be an interesting experiment.
Or if people would have been willing to pay for those things, services that social media provided, instead of capturing our data and using that to make money with by capturing our attention, that could have gone completely differently. But people were not willing to pay for online news and social media at the time.
That might be true. Things would have gone differently. But again, that's a model that exists within capitalism that will do we, you know, that comes down to a more fundamental and philosophic question, which is how much do we want to our society, our social interactions to be dictated by the system of capitalism?
So you're taking a step back and saying it's not just the capitalism that's happening in social media and internet-based technologies, but it's capitalism in general.
That we exist within that framework. And I do think if we're talking about our health as a society and a human population, our social interactions only very recently existed in the framework of capitalism. And I think that's a very fundamental aspect that needs to be taken into consideration.
Okay. That's a whole other conversation, but interesting perspective. Let me go on and talk a little bit about another idea that was new to me within the last couple years, but I find it fascinating and somewhat explanatory for where we are in our state of epistemic health. And that's the idea that's called predictive processing. And we've talked about this on a couple of shows. We did a treatment of this in episode number 43 called Critical Thinking and How Our Brain Constructs Reality. In my understanding is that our evolved basic cognitive abilities led us to develop accurate cognitive representations of the world, maps in our head of what's outside of us, taken in by information through our senses. And we constantly take in new information to shape that representation, that map of the world, toward making maps of reality that are more and more accurate, hopefully more and more accurate. This is called the predictive processing model of the brain. A lot of work and research being done on that. It makes sense because the more accurately we can predict the world, how the world actually works, the better that we can make plans and decisions to thrive in it. This ability to accurately map the world and our development of language, along with our development of language, led to the uniquely human phenomenon, as far as we know on this planet, of rapid and cumulative cultural evolution or coevolution. You and I have talked about that idea. Is it important to you, or is it just kind of another one of those things is sort of obvious. Yeah, we create a map in our head.
Of course, we have to an extent. I mean, even a foraging animal, you know, is going to create a map of its dangers and its food stash and its friendly neighbors. You know, obviously, our lives have become much more complex than a squirrel, but I think it's a necessary tool that we have to have in order to navigate this life. How much we should trust it, that's another conversation.
Well, it's a way of thinking about how people's maps and versions of what's out there and what's real, what's true and what's not true can be so different. You know, that's one of the things that I hear expressed a lot is how can people have such a different grasp on what's real and what's true than I do, you know? And this gives me a little perspective on that, is that we're constantly taking in information. Predictive processing really has to do just with senses, what we take in through our senses. But I'm going to talk next about how I believe that can be used in the abstract sense of taking information about what we really believe, the abstract beliefs that we have. So the predictive processing to me kind of links up with a couple of things. The dual process model is one of them. So I know we've talked a little bit about this before, but I struggle with the idea of the dual process model, which is system one, the intuitive, quick hit on things. And I relate that more to our wired in evolutionarily developed cognitive abilities that I cited a few minutes ago. It's unconscious, largely unconscious. It's not something that we're thinking about or making notes on in paper. It just comes to us. This is the answer to some particular thing. And then our system two, which is the more deliberate, thoughtful system that uses our technology, uses the things that we develop from culture. So I think of system one as being more related to our wired-in biological abilities, cognitive abilities, and system two as being those things that our culture has offered to us to make up for the fact of the very, very slow changes that our biology makes. And I use an example here. For example, if we're trying to think about, well, I need to go across country for something. If you're using your system one, you're using your associative memory, for example, and you say to yourself, I'll travel cross country by car because I just saw a horrific plane crash on the news and everyone died. So that's called the availability heuristic or availability bias. And we've talked about that quite a bit on this program. So that's one way to make a decision. And that would be more the system one. That's the system one, and it relates to those things that we're born with. And we develop and sharpen up, but associative memory being one of those. While if you're using system two, which relies more on cultural technologies, both cultural cognitive technologies like statistics and that kind of thing, and physical technologies like computers, you might say something like, so I'll take a plane because although I remember seeing the plane crash on the news, I decided to look at the National Safety Council website where it gives death by transportation mode, and I saw that it's statistically far safer to drive. So that's the point I'm trying to make, is that our culture has developed technologies that feed into and assist us in our system two thinking. And our system two thinking is a check on our system one, quick, intuitive, more Neolithic type of wired in thought processes.
I think that's interesting because I feel like that exposes a little bit of a bias you might have, that to say that system two keeps system one in check almost sounds like you value system two type thinking more than system one. Would that be accurate, do you think?
I would say that I love the ability to use other than just my quick unconscious idea of making a decision. I love the ability to find data, to analyze data, to use statistical approaches when making decisions. But it doesn't mean that I think we could ever do away with System One or that it doesn't have a place. But we've talked enough about biases, and there's enough research that's been done on biases to know that we should always question our quick hit on things, our quick intuition about things. Sometimes we don't have time to do that. And we've had Gary Klein on this program talking about what he calls skilled intuition, because you can train your intuition too.
Well, that's exactly what I was thinking of, is that, you know, System One's very important for people like firefighters.
Sure.
Who train and train and train. Yeah. And to the point when they actually get called out to a fire, they are System One all the way, and they are tapping into what they've been trained to do. And so I just think it's important not to undervalue the role that that might have. Yes, they need to keep each other in check, but they are both part of what it is to be an integrated human being.
Definitely. And in fact, I understand that Gary Klein is in the midst of writing another book. And when he gets that book done, I would love to invite him as a guest on Thinking Clearly to talk about his ideas, because he's still working with that skilled intuition. He does make a point, just the point that you made, is that there's a place for intuitive, skilled intuitive thinking and decision making, especially when decisions need to be made quickly. You can't have a fighter pilot or an airline pilot who is experiencing an emergency in the aircraft. You can't have them, going to the manual and looking through it and trying to decide, making a decision tree to try to make weighing the risk benefits. And that's got to be done ahead of time and kind of wired in as an automatic intuitive reaction. And that's what skilled intuition is. So no, I'm not biased against, and I realize the strengths of intuitive thinking, but I also realize the pitfalls and value the ability to use things from our culture that help us be an adjunct to our System One thinking.
Yeah, it is definitely important to keep them in check. And, you know, we'll talk a little bit about COVID later, but, something that's been a really important part of this pandemic is having risk assessment. And that is something that really requires some serious System Two thoughtfulness and evaluation.
I do want to point out, though, that we did a whole series on vetting information. And in that series, we talked about ways to engage your System Two thinking ahead of time, ahead of a particular belief or situation that you're trying to understand in more detail. Okay, let's go on. Talk a little bit about polarization, politicization, and something that's called identity protective cognition. Again, these are things that we've talked about before on this program. And I'll start out by saying that political polarization in the U.S. it used to be thought of as mostly a separation between us versus them groups, according to traditional political groupings. I mean, you had liberals and conservatives, independents, and that sort of thing in terms of political parties. But there is a current trend in political science to recognize that a lot of specific issues have been co-opted by one party or another. And if one party co-opts them, the other is against them and says they're for them. The other then co-opts it and says we're against that particular thing. For example, masking and vaccinations in the pandemic are examples of that. That should be just a medical health issue, and it quickly became a right and left issue. So when this polarization develops, and we've talked about that quite a bit on the show, our evolutionary kind of tribal instincts kick in, and we begin to adhere more strongly to our group's beliefs, which influences how we think about the issues, as opposed to thinking each one through on its own and using an evidence-based kind of System Two approach. And that influence on our thinking, that our groups that we identify with, has become known as identity protective cognition. There's been a lot of work on that and talk about that and how it leads to polarization. Polarization can be good. It can work. It can be functional. I don't think you're ever going to completely do away with polarization between people in terms of their beliefs, but it's a quantitative property. If there's some polarization, but not drastic polarization, it can work because people can still negotiate and with each other on issues, try to find common ground and that sort of thing. But when it reaches real high levels, which I think it is at this particular point with regard to certain issues like whether the last election was stolen or not, and whether vaccination and masking is overrated and not completely necessary to stamp out this pandemic. But at any rate, when it reaches really high levels, communication and cooperative problem solving breaks down, where it can kind of be a point of irreconcilable differences and lead to separation and just a complete divorce of people from each other. And that's happening in families quite a bit. So where are you with those ideas?
Well, I'm not a doctor. I sometimes play one on the radio, and I'm hereby diagnosing our American political party system with oppositional defiance disorder. I'm pretty sure that's where we're at right now. Anyways, joking aside, I will admit, polarization happens in a lot of different ways. Things aren't always as clear cut as Democrat and Republican or conservative and liberal, although that is often where people like to draw lines or conveniently find lines to be drawn. But in that regard, it is measurable. Our political polarization in America has been intensifying decade by decade. And you can see it in the way that party votes come out, in the way that voting people support certain issues. I think that's something that's important to keep in mind because, again, that's a system that we can change and affect as players in that system, the political system. Now, I think there's also other conversations to be had about polarization. Politics is muddled in there, but I think it's a lot more complex than that. Polarization of values, of simply just what is important, who do you trust? I think these are really important topics that we need to talk about, and we need to have greater mutual understanding. That's the only way, in my opinion, we're really going to depolarize, is to enhance our mutual understanding. But that is not the direction I see us going in right now.
Yeah. And there are a lot of people that are working towards that, realize that, and are taking different approaches to make that better. It kind of goes along with the impact of cultural change that I've also been thinking a lot about, because I do believe that we are in a period of pretty drastic change in some real basic cultural issues. Same-sex marriage and identity issues and that sort of thing, that's a big one. I mean, that has been ingrained in our culture to the idea that there are males and females and that's all. And if you're not a male or a female, then, you got a problem and you should be changed. And that kind of thinking and idea is really tough for people to get beyond something that has been ingrained in their culture for many, many years. So there's a number of those things that are occurring in this particular time that I haven't seen in my lifetime be as many issues, even though the 60s were tumultuous in many ways. There was certainly a movement for cultural change. Some of the cultural change is taking hold now with the younger people and scaring the bejeebies, I think, out of some of the older, more conservative, traditional people in our society. So, the idea of, you see a lot of headlines and things about the culture war. I did a Google search for culture war, putting culture war in quotes, and it yielded 6 million hits. You know, so it's out there in terms of an idea. But in addition to sort of the internet rhetoric and the headlines around cultural war, is it real? Are we in a tumultuous cultural period? Is that exerting a lot of pressure on the cohesiveness of our culture and that sort of thing? So I searched a little bit for some academic studies on that and did find some support for it. There's not a lot of actual published studies on it, but I did find something that was published in 2016 in the Annals of the American Academy. It's Duane Alwyn and Paula Tufas were the authors of that. And they looked at the issues of abortion, gay rights, women's extrafamilial labor force participation and child rearing. And they concluded, and this was what this was in their conclusion, I'll give a quote, "Egalitarian gender beliefs, preferences for autonomy in child rearing values, tolerant attitudes towards abortion, and tolerance towards homosexuals became increasingly associated with liberal political views, while religious orthodoxy became increasingly associated with conservative political views. This suggests a changing role of cultural orientations in shaping political identities and a heightened importance of cultural orientations." And that's the end of that quote. So I'm thinking that it's like a perfect storm. The invention and prevalence of internet-based technology, especially social media, at a time in human history when money became a proxy for social dominance and winning the attention of others, which became the business model in social media and the internet. And that has a vast potential for making money. And so all that goes, in my mind, a long way in explaining our current social dilemma. What are your feelings?
Just the words culture war, to me, strikes me as rhetoric. I've been sitting with that. Like, what does culture war even mean? You know, and you use like very common examples of wedge issues of queer rights, women's rights. And again, I kind of sit back and go, was desegregation a culture war? You know, I guess I'm asking that both rhetorically and I'm actually asking that because I look back on that and it's, I don't know, maybe it's easier to reflect on that as that was something that needed to happen in our country sooner than later. And it's hard to kind of step back and say, oh, well, you know, culture war makes it sound like a disagreement. But it was a fight for fundamental civil rights and human rights. And I think to frame that as simply a culture war does not fully capture the gravity of the values that are being debated.
Talk a little more about that, because framing it as a culture war, I don't necessarily agree with that rhetoric. That is rhetorical. Calling it a culture war gets headlines or gets people's attention. But I would put it down as, I would stand by this in terms of just my personal experience, that yes, now I didn't live through the Civil War. There was polarization there between the North and the South. But I lived through the 60s and there was a lot of polarization in terms of the Vietnam War, and the United States as a a colonial entity going out and trying to affect other people's decisions in their countries, and a reaction against the sort of traditional father knows best culture in the United States. And that did cause a lot of polarization, and it led to some changes, not as many changes as I would have hoped for, but it did lead to some changes. And human rights became an issue, everything from the rights of mentally ill people to women's rights and et cetera. So there was a lot going on there. But I just get the, and maybe it's a system one intuitive reaction that I'm, you know, that I'm responding to. And if I looked, if I used my system two and looked at statistics and analyzed statistically the amount of change at different epochs in our country, maybe we're not in a huge period of dramatic cultural change, but it seems to me we are. I have the intuition that I haven't lived through as a period where there were so many issues that were being, that there was a pressure to change. Now, these are issues that I tend to agree with. I'm on the liberal side of this. I'm, you know, I think there's a lot of things in our culture that need to be addressed, and the state of our economy, capitalism versus some sort of hybrid socialism or whatever, is one of those issues. But it seems to me that, and I'm kind of sticking with that, that this is an important aspect of the polarization that's going on, is that we, from the liberal point of view, have a hard time understanding, well, what is your issue with same-sex marriage, with gender-neutral restrooms, that sort of thing. It's just hard to see that. It seems like it's clear. Yeah, sure, of course we should, you know. But there are many people that are reacting very strongly. There's also a lot of sort of right-wing radio and right-wing news sources that make a lot of money by using those pressures for some cultural change to co-opt and upset their base too. So, you know, it's being, that's the politicization that I'm talking about. So I'm wondering if, is that a point of difference between you and I? Do you think, does it not seem to you that there is a great amount of pressure for social change happening at this point, and that that is part of understanding what the polarization is?
I would say that is true to an extent. I look at it as a bottleneck. You know, your generation, the 60s and the 70s, there's a lot going on. There's a lot of people getting it together and trying to really affect change. And that really, it didn't stop altogether, but it quieted down for a number of decades. And I think what you have now are two generations that have had the cork put on their bottle, and the pressure has been mounting. I think part of, I guess, what bothers me about the terms of culture war is that we have wars to establish dominance. Who's going to be the political, economic, cultural dominant faction? And so right there, I would stop and say, why are we even having a war? We are, in theory, and by values, a pluralistic society. And so if you have feelings that you don't want to have abortion, you don't want your family members to have abortion, why impose that on somebody else? You know, if you are satisfied with the bathroom that you are using and haven't had any problems, why do you feel it's your place to tell somebody else what bathroom to use? And that's where I do think polarization has been intensifying, is because we're actually leaving less and less room to be the pluralistic society that we supposedly value. And I think that that has been a trend in American history. That pendulum has swung back and forth since our inception, of, you know, just exactly how sectarian and pluralistic are we willing to be?
Well said. I agree. Culture war is not a productive way of framing it. It's an exploitive way of framing it. And because, as you've said, and I strongly agree with, is that it's important to have discussions about our differences, try to find common ground where it exists, and being willing to communicate, trying to understand each other, rather than at war with each other. So,
and I'll add one more thing, I guess, that bothers me about the culture war is, you know, when you refer to war without context, you know, you have two sides, they have a disagreement, they're fighting over something. But I think it's important to keep in mind, what is the seriousness of what we are fighting over? Is it somebody's right to bake a cake, to choose if they want to bake a cake for one person or not? Or is it about who we get to enslave and exploit? Those are two very different issues that have very different implications. Or, you know, I'll bring up the masking. You know, what are the implications of masking? What are the protests? And what is the seriousness of the nature of the issue? I think we lose perspective about that and have collectively lost our S over issues that were really not significantly impactful to us as a society.
Well said. And it makes a good transition, talking about masking. Let's go to that, because I'd like to save a little bit of time in this episode to get into a discussion of the pandemic, the COVID pandemic that we've been experiencing for almost 2 years now, as a challenge to our ability to find common ground and work cooperatively towards common goals. So let's do that by, I'm going to play a clip here. And this is from it's a short clip from episode of Thinking Clearly, episode number 46, which we called Critical Thinking in the Time of Crisis. And this aired on May 7th, 2020. So let's take a listen to this clip.
I think most of us have indulged in misinformation innocently. We didn't know any better, or, you know, it was confirmation bias, something agreed with the thoughts that we already had. But there is also, especially in times of such difficult times as this, that there are those who want to sow chaos and perpetuate, you know, those are the actors in disinformation who are actively trying to spread false information for usually nefarious purposes.
Well said. It's really important, and I feel very strongly about this, and I have seen a lot of this, an improvement, a strengthening of social cohesion and cooperation. That's become exceptionally important with being threatened by this kind of common enemy that we all have, unseen enemy, that is, the coronavirus. And that's got to happen across the social fabric so that everybody gets on the same page, following the same evidence. Based policy. We've had 3 episodes on the value of civil dialogue, on thinking clearly, and finding common ground. And that's another big factor that I'm hoping will take hold as a result of being faced by this common threat.
Yeah, absolutely. I will add too that I often like to point out the difference that there's being civil and then there's just being neighborly. Out of necessity, a lot of us have become much more neighborly. We're looking out for each other. We're helping each other. We still don't have to agree. We still don't have to go to the same church. We still don't have to be on the same page about everything, but we can still pick up the phone and ask, hey, I'm going to the market. Can I pick you up anything?
Yeah. And we saw a lot of that happening, especially the starting point. And you and I were talking a little bit earlier before the broadcast about how it just seems like in the last week or two that things started to go south a little bit with the divisiveness and the protests and that sort of thing that are so unhealthy, in addition to the unhealthiness of a virus. That got my interest. I wanted to go back to that episode that we did May 7th in 2020. We were about 3 or 4 months into the pandemic at that time. And it's interesting that we, me more than you, were pretty optimistic that this pandemic would bring people together to fight this common enemy and reduce our polarization. So where do you think we are now? Did that happen?
It was a simpler time then, wasn't it, Bob?
Way back then, yes. Well, it was a different time.
A lot's happened between now and then. It doesn't, you know, it seems like it could have been ages. It was a simpler time.
I was indeed optimistic. I thought, all right, we have this common enemy. I mean, and I really, at the starting stages, I heard people kind of coming together in a way, you know, maybe that was my bias, my optimism bias, but I did hear people and thought I found some evidence that it was really gonna help improve our state of finding common ground and being able to discuss issues and cooperate. But, you know,
how do you feel today, Bob?
Well, it, as I said in that clip, it started to go south and it continued to go south. You know, I think there's been a great deal of polarization between people now. There are, I have lost my patience with some people. I don't like to do that. It never feels good after a communication when I start losing my patience and thinking this person is hopeless. You know, there's no way I'm going to be able to say anything to counter what they've been hearing on Fox News or whatever. And I don't like that to happen.
I'm really curious about that because I think of you as an incredibly patient person. I don't know that I've ever seen you lose your patience. So it leaves me with a couple questions. What does it take to get Bob to the point in which he loses his patience? And then what do you do when you realize that's happening?
Well, it doesn't take as much as it used to. And to some extent, you know, that may be an artifact of living in a pandemic. I mean, you know, it puts us under stressful conditions, gets us out of our routines, you know, reduces our social contact. And, you know, so it may be to some extent an artifact, but it's just recently, the last, 6 months, year, you know, or so, or maybe even more recent that I've, what it takes to cause me to lose my patience is when I hear people rejecting things that I believe so strongly are true, that vaccinations are, for example, unsafe, and the risk-benefit is such that we should use untried medications like ivermectin instead of vaccinations, in lieu of vaccinations. Now, I know people who have taken that ivermectin and been vaccinated, and I guess as long as they properly heed the doses, that's probably not too bad an idea if they really want to feel safe. But to not take vaccinations in lieu of taking a medication that has been unproven in terms of its effectiveness. When I hear that sort of thing, or I hear people saying, I refuse to mask because it's a plot by the government to get people to be, what would you say I can't even phrase that because it's so alien to me. A plot to get people adhere to what the government is telling you. You know, it's a reaction against that. When I hear that, I begin to lose my patience.
So when you sense yourself losing patience, what do you do?
In the old days, before I started doing this,
when it was a simpler time.
I was able to objectify things a little bit, and I would say, listen, this person feels strongly about this. I'm really curious about why. You know, what is it? What is it that's motivating this person to reject these ideas that I think it's common sense to follow? And I would become curious. So my curiosity may be appreciation for other ways of looking at things. Maybe a little frustration with my ability to explain things clear enough, you know, or compelling enough to help people see things a little differently. So that's what I used to do. And I do that to some extent. I'm not saying that I'm just a raging lunatic when I'm exposed to that kind of thing. But I have noticed in myself that I have given up on people. I have lost patience. I don't want to hear it anymore. I don't want to, I don't have the tolerance to hear the BS that I fairly convinced as I can be, because I have looked at the evidence, I understand the issues. When I see the things that I'm as certain as I can be that are untrue, that people are perpetuating, I have less patience with it. So, but I don't like that. I don't want that to take over and become a predominant way of responding, because I also have strong beliefs that, of course, it's not productive. It just increases the polarization when we give up on each other, when we give up on finding common ground. And I talk to myself and I tell myself, I could almost just listen to some of our episodes as a reminder of having civil dialogues and that sort of thing. But I am admitting that I have reached a point of less patience. And so personally, I am, maybe that's affecting the way I'm seeing increased polarization.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I imagine you, like the rest of us, have probably had some interesting and possibly tense conversations with people close to you, people you care about. Have you been in any situations where you've been concerned that that's damaged or damaging your relationships?
Oh, sure. Yeah. And that's a concern. And I could go back and listen to one of our episodes when we talked completely about that, you know, that situation. And the model, the guest described for us the model of how to have those conversations with and have them more come out more productively. So it's kind of like a person who sees some parts of their behavior, but is not wrapped up in those behaviors strong enough to not see them and not want to, you know, do something to change that. We're not immune from going the route that we are advocating that we don't go. It reminds me of Daniel Kahneman, who studied biases, but in numerous podcasts, I've heard Daniel Kahneman saying, people asking the obvious question, well, you understand this so well, you must not be a victim of any of these biases. And Daniel Kahneman says, of course I am. Just because I understand them doesn't mean I'm immune from it. So, you know, because we're hoping for people finding more common ground, having more civil dialogues, trying to understand the issues better and reducing the polarization doesn't mean we're immune from the feelings that come up that cause those kinds of polarizations. And
absolutely. And in the situation we are all in right now, I think really it takes the extra effort and energy to not participate in polarization and not to further our differences, but actually find ways to come together.
Well, what we've just been talking about really underscores for me how important it is to not only learn communication skills, which are more apt to lead to productive conversations and allow us to more accurately understand each other's thoughts, feelings, and values, but how crucial it is to repeatedly practice those skills until they become second nature to us, and to give some thought ahead of time about the kind of conversations that we want to have. And I want to strongly suggest that one excellent way to gain those skills and practice those skills is by participating in events sponsored by the nonprofit Braver Angels organization. Braver Angels was co-founded by Dr. Bill Doherty, who's a professor in the Department of Family Social Science at the University of Minnesota. And he was our guest on Thinking Clearly. And that was episode number 57, which we titled Political Depolarization, How to Navigate Political Discussions with Friends and Family. And Braver Angels' stated mission is to bring Americans together, to bridge the partisan divide and strengthen our democratic republic. And on their website, which is at braverangels.org, that's one word, braverangels.org. They also bring together people who have at least three common interests. The first being that us as individuals, we try to understand the other side's point of view, even if we don't agree with it. And secondly, in our communities, we engage those we disagree with, looking for common ground and ways to work together. And lastly, in politics, we support principles that bring us together rather than divide us. A Braver Angels, they offer a variety of venues for learning and practicing dialogue and depolarization, including sponsoring both national, and then they have local debates that use what they call a parliamentary format, which is, according to their description, designed to encourage everyone to speak or ask questions, ensures civility in disagreement, and strives for learning and better understanding for everybody. These debates cover a variety of topics, such as, can public schools be trusted to teach about race and racism? And another topic is America due for a revolution? And many of their previous debates can be seen on YouTube, and you can also watch the debate live by registering for it ahead of time. And skills training are another great resource at Braver Angels. They're free and have titles like Skills for Bridging the Divide, Depolarizing Within, and Families and Politics. And they also offer a variety of workshops. For example, their red-blue workshops bring together a small, evenly divided group of conservatives and liberals for a series of exercises designed to help participants clarify disagreements, reduce stereotype thinking, and discover common values. And their Common Ground workshop is described as allowing participants from red-blue workshops to dig deeper into specific issues, recognizing that there's often more that unites us than divides us. And after my admissions in this conversation, on this episode of Thinking Clearly, I realized that I need to dig deeper into the resources at Braver Angels. Check them out at braverangels.org. Well, we're at the end of the time here that we have together, Julia. And as always, I want to thank you so much for a wonderful conversation and your ideas. And until next time, keep thinking
clearly.